Good morning. You've tuned in to 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. It's the Tuesday morning show. I'm Jack Peterson, and this is the third and final part of our three-part series, Worth of a Woman. We'll be joined live in studio later on this hour by Jen Jackson Quintano from the Pro Voice Project. But first, we have a couple of interviews, one with Catherine Larson and Dr. Caitlin Myers. And I will let Kathy introduce Dr. Myers with this recorded interview, which we sat down and recorded late last week. So thank you for tuning in for part three of Worth of a Woman. We have another interview coming up with Lauren Nekachia. And we will, as I said, finish off the show by talking to Jen Jackson Quintano. First, here's Catherine Larson and Dr. Caitlin Myers coming up next. We're in the studio with Catherine Larson, who joins us again, a volunteer with the Pro Voice Project, and also on the phone with Dr. Caitlin Myers. Catherine, I will let you introduce Dr. Myers, if you would.
Thank you. Dr. Caitlin Myers is the John G. McCullough Professor of Economics at Middlebury College in Vermont, which is one of the top-rated liberal arts colleges in the U.S. She's a badass economist who wrote and collaborated on the amicus brief for the Dobbs case for the Supreme Court. She's testified before Congress this year on the economic impact of the lack of abortion access to women and families. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us and for bringing your talents, expertise, courage, and your pursuit of truth through the numbers, your whole self to this work. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to this work?
Sure, and thanks for that introduction. Badass economist is the best honorific I think I've ever received.
Nice.
So I'm actually trained as a labor economist, and I began my career studying gender differentials in labor markets. And you really can't study gender gaps without studying the role that parenthood plays, and the particularly very large role that it plays for women. And so I was studying the questions that were surrounding parenthood and labor market outcomes, and really just came to understand that economists had not spent at that point enough time looking at the role that reproductive autonomy plays in women's economic lives. And so I just started asking questions about, for instance, what was the role of the birth control pill in the 60s? What was the role of Roe v. Wade in the 70s? And as I started to see this undeniable evidence of a very large role for abortion, it just raised more questions about the role of abortion in the present. And I just haven't run out of questions, I suppose.
Yeah, you strike me as the kind of researcher who doesn't have a story that's in search of data, but that you're actually pursuing the data to see what story it builds.
That's exactly right. And I think that, I mean, we all bring different perspectives, backgrounds, and beliefs to our research. For me, I'm coming to it as somebody who is really pretty nerdy. I love data. I love statistics. I particularly love the tools of what we call in statistics and economics, causal inference, meaning a set of tools that we use to isolate and measure causal effects. It's what we do. We don't just throw up our hands in the air at the fact that correlation isn't necessarily causation and go home. But actually, the next question is, okay, so how do you figure out when correlation is causation? And it's really rich, fascinating, rewarding work. And for me, I like applying the tools to this area that had been understudied. And so I didn't really come at it from the perspective of somebody who had any strong prior opinions about abortion policy, about reproductive policy. I came at it as somebody who is really interested in using these tools to seek out truth and provide evidence that hopefully we can all agree on, even if we might not agree on what we do with it next.
Right. So my understanding, you were talking about early on that you were looking at how the pill had impacted women's economics and then ended up shifting that over to abortion. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And in particular, I shifted it over to abortion in part because every piece of data that you look at from the 70s points to the legalization of abortion having a profound effect on the arc of American women's lives. And there's just so much that was really interesting there that I began focusing on the early 70s and the kind of the years surrounding Roe v. Wade in 1973, and then really turned my attention to contemporary abortion policy.
Mm-hmm.
So what was some examples of like the effects of that you can see in the economic realm of Roe v. Wade in 1973?
Yeah, sure. So before I dive into that, and I am happy to dive into it, let me talk a little bit about how we know what we know so that I'm not just kind of like, here's the truth, but I'd like folks to actually understand where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to have a time machine and be able to go back and randomize moments in history so that I could then play it forward in an alternate universe and see what happens. Unfortunately, I don't have that time machine, so I can't go back and randomize the Roe v. Wade decision so that I can measure what happens next. But we do have another opportunity, which is to take advantage of the fact that even before Roe legalized abortion nationwide in January of 73, five states in the District of Columbia had legalized abortion several years prior, beginning in roughly fall of 1969. And that affords us an opportunity to watch how outcomes began to change in those states relative to the rest of the country. And what the evidence shows is that the legalization of abortion dramatically shaped the circumstances under which women became mothers. It reduced teen births by about a third. It reduced teen marriages by about 20%, by about a fifth. And the effect on teen marriage operated almost entirely through dramatically reducing what at the time were often called shotgun marriages, which is not a term that my kids necessarily recognize, but in any event, was used then at least to describe marriages that were taking place because of an unplanned pregnancy. And so we see that there's a reduction in teen births. We see a reduction in teen marriage. And that then had profound downstream impacts on people who used abortion to delay or prevent unwanted motherhood. They became more likely to finish high school, more likely to finish college, more likely to enter higher paying occupations, and more likely to avoid poverty later in their lives, both for themselves and for their families. And I also would be remiss if I did not add to that long list of effects of abortion legalization. Abortion legalization almost also dramatically reduced Black maternal mortality. The estimates are that it reduced deaths for Black women that were related to pregnancy and childbirth by about 30 to 40%.
Wow.
The reason is probably, although it's a little difficult to parse in the data, but the reason is probably that Black women were much less likely than white women in that era to be able to access a clandestine abortion that was safe. From the qualitative evidence, we know that white women were more likely to be able to find a trusted physician who would quietly provide them with abortion or, you know, through a network, somebody who was known to provide safe abortions. And so it really seems likely that the effect is driven by the fact that Black women were more affected by the legalization of abortion. It increased their access to abortion more than it did for white women who were more likely to access safe, illegal abortions.
I wanted to fast forward a little bit because there's a couple of, it seems like you're at the center of the storm and you've kind of been at the center of that storm at a number of different points. So let's go back to 2023 when you were writing the amicus brief for the Dobbs decision at Supreme Court and also testifying in front of Congress. So can you talk a little bit about what you found there and what was that like?
Sure. So the amicus brief would be fall of 2021 was when it was submitted, because the Dobbs decision comes out
right.
In the summer of 2022. Yeah. So I had been working for more than a decade as an academic on like a whole body of scholarship studying the effects of abortion on various demographic and economic outcomes. And I'm not the only one. You know, there were quite a few economists who had entered the field. There was a lot of work being done in this area. And like your kind of stereotypical academic, I was super happy to write my nerdy papers with lots of tables and lots of numbers with stars by them and publish them for other economists to read and then kind of carry on with my academic life. And about 5 years before Dobbs, I started to get occasional requests from attorneys who were working on abortion litigation to serve as an expert witness, to basically come into federal court when various abortion restrictions were being considered and to provide evidence and testimony on the effects of those restrictions. And I said no to the first many requests of that sort. I said no partly just because I'm a parent of four children and I have a full-time day job and it just felt like a lot. And I also said no because I thought my job is to produce the evidence and other people's job is to interpret the evidence and decide what to do with it. And then I started to actually pay attention to what was going on in those courtrooms and what was going on in, you know, various state legislatures and how this evidence was being described. And, you know, I realized I was naive. Maybe everybody else already knew I was naive, but I realized I was naive. I realized that if the experts who produce the evidence don't show up to explain it, that somebody else will. And very often that person will have their own motives. They might distort the evidence or they just might not understand the evidence. And so I came to this realization that if I believe in evidence-based policy, and as a citizen and a scientist, I do, that I have a professional obligation to help explain and disseminate the evidence. And so I started working when time allowed. It certainly still wasn't my day job, but I started working on some of these cases. And so when Dobbs came along, I was connected to attorneys in the field. I understood that Dobbs was coming, but I didn't really expect to play any role there because I assumed wrongly that the only issues in Dobbs would be for the Supreme Court to consider would be issues about personhood and constitutional law. And I've got opinions about them as a person, but that's not my area of expertise as an economist. So I assumed I would sit this one out and watch and pay attention to what happened. What I didn't understand was that Mississippi, in trying to clear the very high bar of stare decisis, which is this norm that the court doesn't like to overturn its own precedents, that Mississippi was going to make a really kind of strong argument. In fact, I would say it's a pillar of its argument to the court, was that Roe and Casey could be overturned without any real consequence to anybody. That basically you didn't need to worry about the precedent because, and they said two things. They said there was no way to know if anybody had ever relied on these decisions to begin with. And they also said that nobody had ever relied on these decisions to begin with and they did not affect outcomes. And so I think those two things are very contradictory.
Yeah.
I think you have to pick one of them. You can't say we don't know and also we know.
Right.
But in fact, if you pick one, they're both of those are wrong. We do have this really large body of evidence. And however you feel about the ethics of abortion, and there I understand there are deep disagreements, the facts about how abortion policy affects outcomes for people, measurable outcomes in the data that we can see for people's economic lives, like those facts are there. And so economists for the first time spoke up in one of these cases. And I basically just sent out a quick call to folks asking if people wanted to be on an amicus brief. I started drafting the brief. I wanted to make sure that every single thing in the brief would be absolutely, you know, agreed upon, not contested. So I sent it to about eight other economists who have written a lot in this field for very detailed feedback. And more than 150 economists ended up signing on. And that, frankly, I think if I'd cast a wider net, it could have been double that number. It was,
wow.
it was really an interesting moment. But so, you know, that's how the brief came to be, is just I understood that there was this question in the case about societal reliance on abortion and that my discipline, we're not the only discipline that has something to say about it, of course, but that my discipline does have quite a bit to say about it.
Yeah, it's really amazing, that story, and the nobility of, like, being there to say the experts need to tell the truth, and the fact that you gathered those people together, especially in this environment of, you mentioned what a complex issue this is, and that people have passionate, deeply held beliefs. Mm-hmm. So do you, I mean, you just talked about this amazing story of bringing people together to be able to tell the truth and put the truth on the table, especially when there was so much disingenuousness in Mississippi saying, we don't know, but we do know, and it's not a problem. How do you think we can go forward in an environment where people are so passionate about their ethical beliefs around this?
I have a great deal of empathy and respect for folks who would place themselves, to the extent that there are clear sides, that would place themselves on opposing sides of this debate. And I think part of that stems from being from the rural South myself. I'm not from Vermont. I'm from very rural West Virginia, from Braxton County, and from Troup County, Georgia. Those are the two places I grew up. I have a lot of family and friends who would say that they are anti-abortion, and they're people who I sit down and have meals with and care about, and I don't simply respond to that belief by assuming that somehow they're bad or wrong. And I think, honestly, they feel the same way about me. I think that when people engage in this topic in good faith, they should be willing to acknowledge that it's complicated. And that's the starting place. It's complicated. There are different dimensions on which we evaluate this. But I also think one of the things that we're really growing to see since Dobbs is that now that abortion bans are a reality, now that a significant fraction of the American population finds themselves hundreds of miles away from abortion providers, now that those hypotheticals of, does it affect anybody, are realities, I think a whole lot of people are much more willing to say it's complicated. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the issues. Let's talk about how access, let's talk about unintended pregnancy. Let's talk about how access to contraception and abortion affect outcomes. Let's not simply brush it aside as no big deal. And I guess I would say that's the starting point. Mm-hmm. Is empathy and respect and a willingness to say that this issue is not an easy one.
And then the data is absolutely critical, because then you can have a conversation with real information.
Sure, I hope so. I do recognize, I think that there are some people who would say that there is, regardless of whatever consequences not being able to access an abortion might pose for somebody's future, right? Whatever the economic consequences, and the sometimes, unique and sometimes awful burdens that pregnancy and motherhood can present to some people. And I say this as somebody who's thrilled to be a mother of four, but it's mm-hmm. not, it's not the case that everybody's in the same situation as me. But looking at those burdens, somebody could still say, I genuinely believe that abortion is simply equivalent to murder, and there is no argument that will ever change that. And I can't, as an economist, I don't have mm-hmm. a response to that. Mm-hmm. But also, when you look at this as a complex issue and the reality of how people talk about it, I mean, you can look, for instance, at how people talk about miscarriages versus, the tragic loss of a older child. I'm not sure most people treat these things. I don't think most people treat these things as morally equivalent. And I think that most people do look at this issue and say it's complicated, and that the facts and the evidence have a role to play in our conversations. They don't answer every question. They don't resolve every debate, but they're important pieces of this.
Is it too early to see any real meaningful data on what the effects are in states that have enacted abortion bans since the Dobbs decision?
Yeah, the data is starting to come in. They're not all in, so I don't have answers to every question that you might want to ask. But what we can see so far is that the Dobbs decision, first of all, has completely reshaped abortion access in this country, and it is a story of inequality. and widening inequality. I'll start with something that I think has surprised a lot of people. It almost feels like a paradox. Even as Dobbs shuttered the doors of brick-and-mortar abortion facilities in banned states, it opened digital windows, and access to abortion in a lot of the country has actually increased because of a tremendous expansion in telehealth, because of more awareness and knowledge and comfort with telehealth medication abortion, and perhaps also just because people are talking about abortion more. And we're actually seeing abortions increase in a lot of the country. And I think that has surprised a lot of people. But that doesn't mean that people haven't also experienced decreased access. It's an inequality story. Mm-hmm. Somebody who lives in Houston, Texas, their nearest brick-and-mortar provider now is in Wichita, Kansas, which is, I mean, wow, a day's drive at best one way. And there are people who, many people, and keep in mind that people who seek abortions tend to be low-income, credit-constrained, parenting, working shift work in difficult situations. Drives like that can be impossible for some people.
Yeah, and already the parent of other kids, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, time off work, childcare, it's really daunting. And what we can see in the data is that the first months in which we could see births resulting from those first bans were early 2023, and we saw an increase in births in early 2023 in the places that were affected that suggested that somewhere, it's a bit of a rough calculation at the moment until we get more granular data, but roughly a quarter of the people who would have gotten abortions before Dobbs ended up trapped by the bans in the banned states after. That's what the data are showing right now. I do want to say I think that probably has already changed because telehealth medication abortion is becoming more and more available.
Is there a spike in maternal mortality associated with that, or a change in maternal mortality at all?
I'm not aware of anybody who's measured it yet.
Okay.
What I'll say is there are additional births. They are to vulnerable populations that have high rates of maternal mortality and morbidity already. But we don't have the full data to measure it. Thank goodness maternal mortality remains a relatively rare outcome, but that makes it statistically hard to pull it out of the data. Morbidity, meaning like complications of childbirth and illness, are outcomes I think we're more likely to be able to measure soon.
So you're talking a little bit about this facilities database work that you've done with the map, and it shows that the distance, it's kind of a division right down the center of the U.S. Can you talk more about what surprised you or what have you found around that, and what trending? It sounds like if the telemedicine is making a big impact, you may have a reversal of that desert feeling, or?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I, for years before Dobbs, was working on a series of projects on the effects that driving distance to abortion facilities had on people seeking abortions. As those distances go up, who can't get there and who can? And knowing that in the decades before Dobbs, distance had been such an important dimension of abortion access, I set out to track it and measure it after Dobbs. And I published my data at Open Science Framework. And for folks who don't like big data sets and statistical software, you can also see it visualized at abortionaccessdashboard.org. And basically, what I've been tracking are these tremendous increases in driving distances in banned states, but not all banned states. It really depends on where you live and what the state of abortion access was before Dobbs. So, for instance, people in most of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, parts of Idaho experienced really large increases in distance because of those states' bans. But people in a state like Missouri didn't, because Missouri was already down to only one provider even before Dobbs. And that provider was right on the Illinois border. And there were other facilities right across the border in Illinois that stayed open. And so distance actually, despite the fact that they have a ban, the actual realities of practical access in Missouri didn't really change because of it. Mm-hmm. They were already in a post-Roe world just about even before Dobbs.
We're in Idaho. Do you have any I mean, it looks like we're kind of the same in that same boat that Missouri is.
Depends on where you live in Idaho. So something kind of interesting in Idaho. So Idaho had facilities in Boise. There were two in the Boise area. And then on the other side of the state, there was one, and they closed. But new facilities and new facilities opened and some prior facilities expanded services both in northern Utah and in eastern Washington and Oregon. And as a result, like if you're in Boise, for instance, distance did not change very much. But in other parts of Idaho, people remain pretty far away from providers. It just depends really on where you are. But then this also ties in to another important dimension of access, which is appointment availability. Just because there's a facility there doesn't mean they're able to meet the demand of a new surge of patients traveling out of banned states. And the second piece of data collection that I've been doing is I have a group of students who every quarter survey in about 2 days, they call every abortion facility in the country and they collect information on appointment availability. And what we saw was that in some parts of the country where providers were really on the front lines to receive floods of patients coming out of banned states, we saw that they were really struggling to meet that demand. And so, for instance, if you were in Houston, Texas, driving north to Wichita, Kansas, for about the first year after Dobbs, they mostly didn't have appointments available if you called. Mm-hmm. And if you went farther to Kansas City, they didn't have appointments available either. But now that's starting to reverse. We're starting to see that capacity is improving.
Yeah, we're actually experiencing that as well outside of abortion, just for women's health care. Way up in the panhandle of Idaho.
And mm-hmm.
So I was calling about an appointment for an issue and couldn't get even a first appointment for 8 months in Spokane, driving across the line. So that availability of appointments for any kind of women's health care seems like it's been impacted.
Yeah, this is another, I think, I suspect unintended consequence of Dobbs, which is that the qualitative evidence that I actually have a paper coming out very soon with quantitative evidence on this, but I can't quote it yet. Mm-hmm. But the qualitative evidence is that obstetricians and gynecologists are moving out of banned states for a variety of reasons. The stories you hear vary, but in some states where, and this includes Idaho, where the exceptions to the abortion ban aren't perceived by providers as being very clear, providers feel like they can't offer the best medicine up to standards of care, which involve caring for complex pregnancies, ectopic pregnancies, pregnancy complications that may require that a pregnancy be terminated. And you're seeing in the survey evidence and in people voting with their feet that a lot of reproductive health care providers are expressing a great deal of concern and demoralization. We're also seeing that people who might come and train to be obstetricians in those states aren't as keen to come and train because they are worried that they won't be able to obtain training in the full spectrum of reproductive health care.
Yep.
Are you able to talk at all about what the downstream effects of that are, of our loss of, I think the number is about 55 women's health care professionals have left the state of Idaho and have been replaced by only two incoming, so it's in progress here right now. Do you know, outside of just the abortion issue, just the loss of women's health care, do you have any insight into what kind of effect that has on the from an economic perspective?
We're waiting to measure it.
Yeah.
So it's a really good question. The theories, and I don't think that they'll surprise anybody, there's a few places that we're looking for effects, but we're waiting on data. So the first one is we're all waiting to see what the effects of this might be on women's health. If you have people who are reproductive health care providers not wanting to locate in particular areas, you might expect that the decreased access to care is going to show up in infant and maternal health and other health outcomes. So we're waiting for primarily for claims data, which are just unfortunately slow to be released, to be able to measure that. The other thing that we're starting to see is some evidence that people, that women who aren't necessarily planning to need an elective abortion in their lives are expressing concern about locating to these states because they're worried about simply being pregnant there with a wanted pregnancy. And it's tough to disentangle that in the data. There is some new evidence, for instance, that undergraduates, well, like 18-year-old women graduating from high school became less likely to apply to colleges in states with abortion bans, for instance. But we're still waiting for more data to come in on this.
That's interesting. Obviously, we could talk about this all day long. We have we're reaching the end of our allotted time. Catherine, is there anything else you want to ask before we sign off?
Well, I would say, Dr. Myers, is there something that we did not ask that you would want to share with us?
The last thing I suppose I'd like to point to, if I could have any last word, is for folks who are interested in the future of abortion access, pay attention to medication abortion. What we've seen since Dobbs is that use of medication abortion has skyrocketed, and that providers in states with shield laws have started shipping these medications into banned states. Telehealth abortions, the last data we have from the end of 2023 is that telehealth abortions accounted for 20% of all abortions in this country by the end of 2023. And that is just amazing. That is remarkable. And the future of access to telehealth abortion feels fragile to a lot of people. There's a concerted effort now on the part of anti-abortion forces to target medication abortion and telehealth abortion. The next big outcome, the next big case will be the outcome of the Alliance case that the Supreme Court will release this summer, and we should all pay attention.
Yeah. So that's the I'm not going to be able to say that.
Mifepristone.
Yes, that
one. The Mifepristone case, yes. Mm-hmm.
The 20% abortion compared to what? You said that 20% of the abortions now were telemedicine or medical abortions.
Telemedicine, 60%. So just to kind of, let me drill into that statistic a little bit for you. So there are basically two types of elective abortions: medication abortions, which generally involve a two medication regimen, or procedural abortions, which usually involve a gentle aspiration procedure. Medication abortion, those medications can be provided in person by people, you know, people go to brick and mortar facilities and get those medications. But they can, since COVID, they're increasingly being provided via telehealth, where it's direct to patient. They can be mailed to people's homes. So medication abortions are about 60% of all abortions in this country right now. Telehealth abortions are about 20% of all abortions in this country right now. And obviously, telehealth abortions are the medication abortions being sent through the mail.
Yeah. So that 20% is part of the 60.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. But that means you're able to just receive the that medication in the mail and take it in your own home following the instructions of a doctor you've spoken to or professional you've spoken to either
exactly.
Over the phone or yeah.
Exactly. Well, and now what's happening, because states have shield laws that are designed, although they haven't been tested, but they're designed to protect providers in places like Massachusetts who are shipping these medications to states like Idaho and Texas. And so it means now that people in banned states who are aware of and comfortable and good candidates for this option can talk to a licensed healthcare provider in a state like Massachusetts, be evaluated, and then receive the pills in the mail.
Well, something to watch as that case approaches. I think with that, we are going to have to leave it there. Dr. Caitlin Myers, thank you very much for your time. Catherine Larson.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
for being
you so
here
much.
In the studio. Yeah, thank you for your time and expertise, and we'll...
thanks for your work, too.
You are listening to 88.5 KRFY. My name is Jack Peterson. We're here live in the studio with Jen Jackson-Quintano, having just listened to that interview with Dr. Caitlin Myers and Catherine Larson. Good morning, Jen. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
It's great to have you back for the third and final week of this Worth of a Woman series. I guess right off the bat, any response to the to that interview with Dr. Caitlin Myers? How did that? What did you think about that conversation that mainly Catherine and Caitlin Myers had? And we just got to kind of eavesdrop on there.
Yeah, I've appreciated these past few weeks being able to talk about the concept, the idea of worth of a woman through different lenses. And it was lovely to get Dr. Myers' take, you know, the economic take on that and the value of women's lives, you know, through an economic lens. And I think the question, the worth of a woman, is something that's currently playing out in abortion policy at the state level. We're certainly seeing that here and, you know, weighing a woman's worth versus the worth of the pregnancy that she's carrying. And Caitlin had, you know, some really good statistics about women, the impacts on women's lives being able to choose when they will be pregnant and when they will become parents. And I just think that there is, it's an economic question, and it's much broader than that, about how we value women and whether we only value them for their ability to bring life into the world or if there's more than that. And this is a big, big conversation, obviously. And one thing that Caitlin did bring up, she brought up empathy and respect and the need to bring those elements to these conversations. And I absolutely agree with that. You know, she mentioned she comes from a more rural conservative background and her family members may have different belief sets than she does. But the importance of talking about this very complex issue with empathy and respect for the people who have differing views from us. I think there's a lot we can learn from one another if we stop just, sticking to our talking points, sticking to our guns and listening. And it doesn't mean that we necessarily have to, you know, change our core belief systems, but to be able to have empathy for each side of the debate and understand why someone would consider themselves pro-life and why someone would really want a woman to have agency and autonomy and to consent to what happens with her body. I think these are conversations that are important to have in a sort of a storytelling framework rather than pointing fingers. So I appreciated that she brought that up too.
Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, what you are all about over at the Pro Voice Project, which focuses, of course, on the state of Idaho and our issues here in North Idaho. But this is our second conversation with somebody from, we spoke to Dr. Jennifer Hill from Bozeman a couple weeks ago, and now we just finished talking to Dr. Caitlin Myers from Vermont, living now in Vermont. Have you had an easy time reaching out just across the country to these experts in various fields?
This seems to be an issue that really resonates with people right now. I mean, it's all over the media, certainly. We're seeing stories of the ramifications of the fall of Roe. And so we're constantly reading those stories. And it is a lot about personal stories, personal narrative in the news right now, telling various women's stories from across the country and how they're impacted. And so I think we're just awash in this right now. And there is a great interest on behalf of scholars and lay people alike to kind of delve into this and figure out where we're headed and what this means and where do we go next. And I've seen that in Idaho, too. There is a great interest in talking about this, which I think is wonderful because there's been so much stigma in the past in talking about reproductive health and talking about abortion. That's a word that we've been afraid to use. And there's now this opening because the issue is so ascendant right now to delve into this and to talk about it in a way that we really haven't before. Because we have to figure out how we set our course moving forward. And I don't think a lot of us are happy with the course that's set right now. Polling numbers show that in Idaho for sure, that, you know, whether you agree or not with the intent of the laws on the books, their impacts are being felt statewide. The impacts are not good. And so it's important to have these conversations and figure out what a better approach is.
Hmm. Well, we have another recorded conversation that I think I will introduce right now. Cynthia Dalsing was here, a retired nurse, midwife. She'll be one of the main voices that you hear on this recording. She was here in the studio with me. And also Lauren Nekachia, who is now the outgoing representative from Idaho District 19A down in Boise. She is also the new chair of the Idaho Democratic Party. So I believe right now we'll go into that interview and then be back very briefly after this. We're going to go a little long today, and we'll be here on the morning show probably until about 9:15 or so. So thanks for listening, and without further ado, here's Cynthia Dalsing and Lauren Nekachia, again recorded here in the studio late last week.
Representative Nekachia, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm here kind of wearing a couple of different hats. I do happen to be a retired nurse midwife, but I am speaking more on the organization Pro Voice Project. I don't know if you were at the Boise event with Jen Jackson Quintano.
I was.
Okay, so you have a sense of kind of the energy and the voice that Jen has started to give to women, in particular since the trigger laws were passed in Idaho and Roe was overturned.
You were appointed to the legislature in 2019 and then were reelected in 2020 and 2022. And if reports are to be believed, you've now served your last session or your barring a, you know, an emergency session of the legislature. So you are not seeking reelection, but you have been in the state legislature for about five very turbulent, impactful years. Mm-hmm. What we'd just like to get from you is a sense of what it's been like to be in the legislature. How did we get to this point, and what was the fight like, kind of on the front line, so to speak, at least legislatively?
Yeah, specifically on reproductive freedoms.
Yeah.
So one of my colleagues cynically jokes that you can't fundraise off of last year's abortion bill. Mm-hmm. And so I got just accustomed to abortion, you know, even when we had the protections of Roe v. Wade, just abortion was ever present. And you just kind of had to be ready to debate about abortion every year. We have a committee on the House side, the House State Affairs Committee, where you look at just the committee's purview, how it's defined, what topics it covers. You know, abortion is listed as a topic that the committee deals with. We don't have any other medical procedure that is, you know, officially assigned to a committee. And so I saw early on, even though it was everyone's kind of understanding that Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, that the Republicans were going to push and push because it was how they scored political points with the anti-abortion hardliners. It was how they secured, you know, the endorsements and the funding from the anti-abortion hardliners. So they were going to make it an issue, no matter what. And, you know, whatever bill really came to the House floor or the Senate floor, it was going to pass. It was as if, you know, I've said this before, but it is, you know, I saw people who I know are thinking people on the other side of the aisle. It was as if their brains left their bodies. They didn't want to think about the bills. They just wanted to pass it and be done with it, and you know, not get any political damage. And, you know, maybe privately somewhere, maybe they thought this was bad legislation. You know, for instance, the bill, when we passed the Texas style bounty bill that included cash awards for rapist family members, if they wanted to pursue that, if the victim chose to have an abortion, that there wasn't a lot of debate. There wasn't a lot of, they weren't, a lot of them weren't super proud. They weren't standing up and heralding this as great legislation. I think they wanted the debate to end as quickly as possible and you know, just get their points for their vote and, you know, pretend that they weren't doing these harmful things. So it's, you know, it has, and it hasn't gotten better since Roe v. Wade fell. And now all of that, those deliberately sloppy policies and these laws that conflict each other are wreaking havoc, and there's no political will to solve them.
Do you hear specifically from your constituents about how these laws have impacted them? I mean, I know there is a court case going forward from some women in Idaho, but do women contact you or families contact you about how this has impacted their choice to have a baby, stay in Idaho, or that they had to leave Idaho to go get care?
I've heard various things. I've heard from parents who have a child who's getting medical training and who said, well, I definitely won't come home to Idaho. I got an email from a woman who was frustrated, who usually takes a vacation with her women friends to a resort community in Idaho. She was angry at what policymakers have done here, and she doesn't want to come to our state anymore and recreate. Because I am in a district that does have more healthcare access than probably any other district, the main St. Luke's Hospital is in my district. It's where I was born, where my second child was born. Wow. We aren't yet seeing what Sandpoint has experienced in other communities where there's just no labor and delivery services at all. But we're lucky that we're, you know, an hour from Oregon, so I think that also helps ease some of that on this side of the state. But I know it's not as easy elsewhere, and the fact that we're making it so much more costly and stressful for women to get care is heartbreaking. And I'm reading the same stories in the newspaper that others are, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. The Republicans have a supermajority in the legislature, the Senate. They obviously, our governor is a Republican. The Democrats, to some extent, seem to be just along for the ride. Do you have allies on the other side of the aisle who are, or are you at least in conversation with Republicans about issues around women's health care?
Yeah. So to some extent, we are, you know, and I know I have friends across the aisle who would love to pass a health exception to the abortion ban, who see the damage that it's causing. But because of the Republican power structures, a bill is not going to see the light of day. And, there was a bill that did very little, and it got printed over a year ago, and, you know, the day before the bill was to be heard in House State Affairs, the chair of the Idaho Republican Party made calls, the anti-abortion hardliners, some of them who I guess maybe had been, people changed their mind, just people said, no, never mind, we don't want this. And part of that is, you know, our Republican Attorney General, Ro Labrador, working with the national anti-abortion activists who are absolute hardliners who are trying to, you know, win that U.S. Supreme Court case. So they can't win that case and say, look, it's legal, it's okay, we can have legislation that means you can't get an abortion to, you know, protect your health, preserve your fertility, or, you know, prevent deterioration of your health. We can have a law that just says, you know, it's only allowed to prevent imminent death. That's the standard we can go by. That's what they want nationally. They want to make Idaho this kind of national test case. And so that's what's blocked in part, you know, any sort of attempt to nibble around the edges and make this just give a little bit of breathing room for doctors who don't have to choose between, you know, preserving the health of a patient and 5 years of prison time. Like, we're putting doctors in an impossible situation. So of course they're trying to escape the state, because who would want to work in that condition?
I guess this would then, this is kind of venturing into the realm of speculation here. But what comes next on a legally, either legislatively or in the courts? Is this what do you foresee happening or changing as time goes on? Is there any kind of legislative strategy on, you know, any kind of arrangement between in the legislature to make changes to the existing laws that you're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, so there are groups of doctors working diligently to, again, get this health exception on the books. What the next thing, and so that will continue, and they'll continue working on that in January. I think they're not optimistic unless we see major electoral changes. The other next thing that will happen is in June or July, we'll get that U.S. Supreme Court decision. And that's the difference between patients being airlifted out of state, as is happening right now, and doctors being able to say, okay, this is a medical emergency. I can do what I need to do to stabilize the patient. And not, you know, put someone on a helicopter where it might mean that an infection gets worse and then they have to have, you know, a hysterectomy and never get the chance to have a child again. So it's just a tiny bit of a relief we could get from the U.S. Supreme Court. And it is just telling just how devastating it's gotten, and that Republicans, the Republican leaders are just gaslighting doctors at this point. They're saying that, you know, the doctors are lying, and they're talking, the Republicans are talking about out of both sides of their mouths, because they're saying doctors can do everything they need to do, but then why are they fighting this ruling so hard to have that harsh language in place and to be able to prosecute in medical emergencies unless the doctor can really say that death is imminent. So we'll see what happens, and you know, we're going to see what happens on Tuesday with the Republican primaries and who comes out of that, and if all those power structures stay the same. And then we'll see what happens in November. One of the reasons I'm not running for the legislature again is because I want to focus on getting more people elected who are going to protect our reproductive freedoms. And so rather than work on my own campaign this cycle, I'm going to be focused on, you know, those swing districts. Where can we pick up seats? Where can we make sure we've got Democrats running in every single legislative district to start creating more of that accountability? Because there are Idahoans out there who don't know yet how drastic this is, and they might find out in just the most impossible, terrible way with, you know, say a diagnosis of a non-viable pregnancy, and with the only option of going out of state.
I do think there is the group, I think you're referring to the Idaho Coalition for Safe Healthcare, that group of healthcare professionals who presented an exceptional committee hearing at the very end of our legislative session this year about how these laws are impacting practice in Idaho, women's healthcare, and the lack of recognition that it got by the legislature and the lack of formal acknowledgement that it got, I thought was very discouraging.
Yeah, I think there are plenty of my friends on the other side of the aisle who don't want this information out there. They were originally going to have these doctors an official presentation and an official joint committee hearing of the health and welfare committees from both chambers, from both the Senate and the House. I think once the House Speaker got wind of that, it was announced, it was, you know, on the calendar for the next day. I think once the House Speaker got wind of that, just the move was, no, don't hold this hearing. Don't give any oxygen to this information. Why would we be broadcasting information about the harmful effects of our laws is the strategy they're taking. So that was disappointing, but I was so glad to see that the physician groups regrouped and held just a public presentation. I can tell you almost all of my Democratic colleagues attended, and I was there taking notes, and a small fraction of the Republican legislators were there. You know, we're only 18% of the body, but we were, I think, more than half of the legislators who attended.
It's interesting to me. I mean, it's like a COVID reboot here that people with a huge amount of education, 12 to 16 years post high school, are being relegated to, they don't know what they're talking about, and people who have no experience in healthcare and people who have maybe very minimal education after high school are making these laws that are so impactful, not just to women's health, which I'm kind of looking at what is our mortality rate going to be now, because Idaho does not have a good mortality rate. We already are an underserved healthcare state, and now more people are not coming and more are leaving. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's going to happen with our schools? So I talked about how this project we did talks about how women create community. Well, if you don't have women and families moving into a community, what are you going to have left?
That's exactly right. You know, how our business is going to retain and attract and retain the most talented employees if people are looking at Idaho and saying, this is not a place where I'm even treated as if my life matters. You know, the Idaho Republican Party's official platform, and they keep going to more and more draconian measures to get legislators to stay in line with the platform. But it says, you know, it equates abortion with murder, which is, you know, an offense punishable by capital punishment, and has no exception for even, you know, to prevent the death of the mother.
I was at recent meeting where we talked about the Parental Rights Act, and I was with counselors and nurse practitioners who provide counseling to minors and provide STD and birth control. And I can tell you there was an alarm in that room about how are we going to be able to take care of under 18 and under with this Parental Rights Act now. I mean, once again, you could just see them starting to pack their bags.
Right. Yes. So that's, you know, the new law they passed this session. I tried to plead to the governor that he should look at it and veto it. But, you know, it's for good reason that we allow a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old to go to a doctor and get, you know, mental health treatment or sexually transmitted infection test. And if you put up that barrier and say you have to have parents' approval, that's going to be a problem. That's going to be a problem. It's going to be a public health problem.
Yes, it is. Well, kind of, you know, on this grim kind of line of questioning, do you have some hope for the future? I mean, you obviously are moving in a position that you want to create a bigger voice for people who do not like this legislation. So what are you thinking is down the road?
I have to remain hopeful because I want to stay in the state. This is my state. This is where I'm, you know, raising my kids. It's where my parents are, all my family. And so I have to remain hopeful. And I think one of the things that gives me hope is seeing over and over again, whether it's in, you know, public opinion polls or when we had the citizen-led effort to overwhelmingly pass Medicaid expansion because the Idaho legislature wouldn't do it. I see that Idaho voters are on the right side of these major issues, and we can make progress off of that. Now, if every Idahoan thought like these Republican legislators who are so far out of touch and just catering to the most anti-abortion hardliners, you know, then I would say, oh gosh, what do we do? They're doing what the voters want. I don't know where do we go from here? But they're not. This is not what voters want, and so that's where I see the room for improvement. And that's why I'm so dedicated to flipping some seats in this election, because the Idaho Republican Party also needs to see some accountability. I think they've been able to act with impunity because they've been this supermajority. And we've got two things, you know, working against us as for those of us who are Democrats, and that, you know, we just have a lot of cultural Republicans, people voted Republican for a long time, and they don't give it much thought, and maybe I haven't even had a Democrat to vote for in the legislative race because their district was historically red, and so Democrats don't run very often. So there's that. But then we have this, and I think you see this in North Idaho more than anywhere else in the state, maybe, although it is coming to Ada County, but we have this migration of far-right folks who see Idaho as fertile ground for a very extreme agenda. So they aren't coming to Idaho because they think we're conservative and you know, end of story. They think, oh, this is a conservative place, and this is, and we can make it much, much more conservative. This is where we can, you know, get in and, you know, not have Medicaid at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, our Democratic caucus is small, and, you know, we're only 18% of the legislature, and we need a lot more. We need that balance. But our caucus is actually really pivotal in passing basic things like the Medicaid budget, or passing, you know, the launch scholarship bill that's going to help, you know, the next generation of Idahoans go into those high demand careers, whether it's nursing or welding or something else. Those things only pass because our small little caucus is there and we're committed to our principles, and we don't play games with those votes. We vote for, you know, the best thing for Idaho. So that's what gives me hope, is that the voters are with us on these really important issues, and we just have to keep doing the work.
In national politics, it seems that the effects of the Dobbs decision have been more beneficial to the National Democratic Party than they have been to the National Republican Party. At least that's kind of conventional wisdom analysis of it. And I think you were just speaking kind of that you hope that's more or less the trend here in Idaho. Is there any evidence of that? We haven't had the same kind of referendum or initiatives that some other states have seen, in their, or any elections, any statewide elections that can, you know, really speak to that. And at least up here in North Idaho, polling is actually pretty hard to come by. So all we really have is anecdotal evidence. I don't know. What's your read of the situation as it stands in Idaho compared to like the national political scene?
I think my sense of just kind of general polling on this issue is that voters have turned in Idaho even more pro-choice, and even less, and even if they don't identify as pro-choice, much more hesitant to have, you know, government laws and criminalization of medical care. So people might say an abortion is not something I would probably ever choose myself, but I don't believe in the government making that decision for my friends and neighbors and everyone in my community. So I think we're trending in the right direction that way. I think, you know, we'll see, you know, this November, if we can make some ground on flipping seats towards candidates who are ready to restore reproductive freedoms. I think that remains to be seen, and that's a little bit in tension with other factors like redistricting, the conservative migration, and all these things that do make politics challenging in Idaho. And then the big question is that there's a new group launching an effort to explore a ballot initiative to restore abortion access in Idaho. That wouldn't have come on the ballot until 2026. But I think there's going to be a lot of support for it. And I think the support will only grow as Idahoans see the devastating impacts of what's happening. Right now, most Idahoans probably don't personally know, you know, a woman who's been airlifted out of state for a medical abortion, or who now has to drive 100 miles to deliver a baby or to even see an OB-GYN and get prenatal care, or someone who can't get in to see maternal and fetal medicine specialist at all, because half of the ones we have already left the state. So it's just that the impact starts small, and then people start to, and this is what happens. This is what happens to, I see on the other side of the aisle. Republican legislators have to, it has to happen to some, to themselves or their family or someone they know closely before they see it as a problem. And that's, I think, a key difference between Republicans and Democrats. Whereas I can imagine the harm caused and want to stop it before it impacts, you know, me personally. But we will just see the support grow as these harsh impacts continue, as labor and delivery services continue to close, as access gets harder and harder. And, you know, Cynthia, to your point, as we see changes in the maternal mortality rate and other harmful things. So I don't relish any of those bad things happening. And what I want is for us to proactively be able to stop them. I do think they will be creating more demand among voters for the changes we need.
Well, Representative Necochea, you've been very generous with your time already. I think that's going to about do it for us, unless, Cynthia, you had anything else you wanted to say.
Well, I could talk to you for a couple of hours, but yeah. I agree with Jack. We'll have to pick up this conversation down the road. I really appreciate your time and your energy with helping us go forward, trying to get more balance in Idaho.
Yes, it's gonna take all of us.
Now we go back to resume and conclude our conversation with Jen Jackson Quintano, just the way we started this series 3 weeks ago. I forgot to hit record right at the beginning of our talk, so we'll resume just a couple of sentences into Jen's concluding thoughts.
You know, with the Pro Voice Project, I'm trying to get residents' voices and stories out there, and people are bravely sharing their stories about why they may have needed an abortion or how they've had a hard time accessing care. And we're tired of those stories of real struggle falling on deaf ears. So I'm very excited about the possibility of a ballot initiative campaign in 2026 that was mentioned during this hour. It's an opportunity for, you know, people to really be seen and heard on this issue and to have a voice on this issue. So that's the big hope that I hold.
2026, yes, ballot initiative is possible depending on the efforts of the various groups involved. Before we go, we should mention again, how can people learn more about the Pro Voice Project and where can they see the Worth of a Woman exhibit?
Yeah, so you can go to the Pro Voice website, www.theprovoiceproject.com. And the Worth of a Woman exhibit is up at Bluebird Bakery until June 13th, and then we'll be moving it elsewhere throughout town. But please drop by Bluebird. It's an incredible exhibit, and it deals with all aspects of reproductive health care and how we value women. It's really worth checking out. So please go visit.
I checked it out myself. It's very cool. And I got a cookie to boot.
Well, good.
Yeah. it's neat, the way it's arranged there at Bluebird Bakery. Anything else coming up for you this summer? Anything else we should know about on the, you know, looking ahead on the calendar?
Looking ahead on the calendar, we've had a lot of programming so far this spring. There will be three community conversations organized and facilitated by the Idaho Humanities Council on the topic Worth of a Woman, and those will be at the Sandpoint Library. I will have those dates posted on the Pro Voice website. They'll be on the library website and also on the worthofawomanidaho.com website. But it would be great to have as many people as possible turn out for those conversations. The Idaho Humanities Council does a great job with these facilitated conversations that help communities delve into some difficult topics. So. Mm.
We're over time and we're going to continue our regularly scheduled programming. Jen, thank you so much for these past 3 weeks of conversations. It's been enlightening across the board. Each one more interesting than the last, I would say.
Absolutely. Thank you for dedicating so much airtime to this. It's a really important topic, and I appreciate the chance to explore it.
We're going to, continue with our regular programming, starting with Bird Note. I have a song queued up called Hospital, since the impetus for this was the closure of labor and delivery services a year ago at our own Bonner General Health here in town. And I will just mention that it is election day. And tonight I'll be here probably about 8 o'clock or so. As soon as the first early returns are posted, we'll be broadcasting those here and throughout the night live on 88.5 KRFY. So you can tune in, listen to what's going on the radio, listen to some good music. And every once in a while, I'll be jumping in with the latest results from the election. So you don't even have to wait to read the paper in the morning to see who won. You can catch it right here on Panhandle Community Radio.